Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
As you know, we often begin these podcasts with an expression of gratitude to the subscribers who support my endeavors. And over the weekend, I was at my local independent grocery store, supermarket, and ended up chatting with the guy in front of me. And after a minute or so, he turned around and he said, "I know you." And I thought, uh-oh. And then he said, "I subscribe to your podcast." So today I want to thank Franklin A. Brown Jr., who has been supporting my podcast for almost 3 years now. And he just happened to be in front of me in line at the check stand. Thank you, Frank. Today we're going to talk to one or more seed freaks. There's no P in there, seed freaks. We're talking about protecting the historical supply of seeds for growing food and flowers and everything else.
Standing at the crossroads, trying to read the signs, to tell me which way I should go to find the answer, and all the time I know.
And the crossroads Eric Clapton, I'm sure, is referring to are a sign with one way pointing to GMOs and the other one pointing to organic.
Let it blossom, let it flow. In the sun, the rain, the snow.
Janice Ray has written a powerful and conversational new book called The Seed Underground, A Growing Revolution to Save Food. And she joins us live from her seed-filled living room on a 46-acre farm in South Georgia. Janice, thanks for talking with us today.
Gosh, Peter, it's all my pleasure. Thanks.
Now, you are really in love with procreation of the plant variety. Your book just, it really expresses your lifelong love affair with growing things. And you have produced at least one child, Silas, who you reference in the book. But your heart is clearly with seeds and plants.
You know, Peter, not to just jump into seriousness, but I think it's I think it's almost in our DNA that we as humans have this a really primal relationship with plants and with the foods that produce our plants. We have been domesticating, adapting, modifying, hybridizing a plant foodstuff for at least 12,000 years, and now some scientists are saying as much as 70,000 years. So it's primal. You're exactly right, and I love it.
And we really do have a significant crisis on our hands, because corporate companies led by Monsanto have basically cornered and now control the market of seed. And as you point out in the book, if you go back to 1901, the book American Varieties of Vegetables showed that there were about 7,262 seed varieties. And as of today, we're down to about 430. Now, that is a stunning decline. And as you point out in the book, this has come in waves. It started with a move to hybrid wheats in the 1930s.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us a little more about this progression. If we just start at the beginning of the last century, about how seed stocks have declined, and you know, farmers have in some cases been manipulated or blindsided, in other cases just gone along with the flow, so to speak.
You're exactly right. Scientists are still really trying to get a handle on the true numbers. The UN says 75% of seed resources worldwide have been lost. There are studies in this country that vary, but in general, people accept around 94% of seed varieties available at the turn of the 19th century were no longer available 100 years later. The loss is due to a handful of reasons. Fewer of us live in rural areas, 80% of us now in urban situations, and then fewer of us farm. In 1900, 41% of Americans, now less than 2%. But mostly, we have most of this genetic erosion is caused by the industrialization of agriculture. Farmers have fewer seeds, fewer choices about what seeds to plant. Markets have consolidated to a handful of corporations. Three multinationals control half of the seed market globally. That would be Monsanto and DuPont, U.S.-based companies, and Syngenta, a Swiss company. So mainly the loss is just human abandonment and neglect amid this rapidly changing landscape of agriculture, society, and economics.
You remember Joni Mitchell's song, Big Yellow Taxi? They took all the trees and put them in a tree museum. Well, that's what's happening with seeds now. There are people who are carefully collecting and trying to preserve certain strains, but it is almost like a museum situation, isn't it?
It is. A few years ago, a lot of seed councils and so forth around the world got together, governments, and helped Norway build this global seed vault at Svalbard. So it's in the Arctic, and you know, it's permanently frozen. Refrigeration units bring the temperature there way below freezing, and so from all over the globe, these seeds are being brought to this underground tunnel that we hope is going to be impenetrable to rising seas, to ferocious storms, to whatever climate variability may be facing us in the future. But the problem is that seeds have a lifespan. We know the oldest seeds that I know about that have been found were 600 years old, found in Argentina, a species of Acana that was poked into a walnut, a green walnut, which then dried and became a rattle. And the shell of the walnut was carbon dated at 600 years. But in general, if you and I open a pack of cucumber seed, plant a few in our garden, that seed's going to last about 7 years once we return it to a plastic baggie and put it in the refrigerator. The best gene banks for seeds are living gardens. And that's why, as you say, that's why I think of these gardeners who are knowledgeable about what's happening to our seed supply. I call them quiet revolutionaries, because all over this country, there are people who are working against what Vandana Shiva calls monocultures of the mind, which is that, you know, as forces of corporations take over, they produce larger and larger monocultures. So that takes us back to industrial ag. The Green Revolution shepherded in commercialization, mechanization, standardization, and chemical fertilization. And the loss of seeds is just one of the chinks in the armor of our food supply.
And we're going to talk about GMOs and corporate farming and all of that arena in a moment. But your focus really is on preserving the rich biodiversity that seed stocks represent. And a lot of that, as you point out, because of the limited shelf life, 7 years in some cases, the best way to preserve a strain is to plant it and grow a new generation and harvest seed from this latest generation of that strain. Am I correct?
Yes. And Gary Nabhan, the great author and seed saver, you know, one of the founders of Native Seed Search, I heard Gary say it. He talks a lot about the way to preserve a plant is to eat it, or to preserve genetic diversity is to eat. And that's such an interesting idea. I think the loss of biodiversity is a loss to our palates and to the beauty of our tables and, you know, the diversity of taste. But we also have to look, Peter, at this very real lurking challenge, which is the less diverse any system is, the greater the potential for its collapse. We see this from the potato famine in the mid-1800s in Ireland. 90% of Irish families grew a potato variety called the Lumper. And a late blight suddenly began to harm the potatoes, not so much in the garden, but in storage. Tubers were rotting. So whereas an acre could feed an entire family for a year, suddenly there was a widespread famine that led to the diaspora of an entire people.
And that's why I'm here.
Oh, good.
My ancestors left Ireland during the potato famine.
Wow.
Yeah.
So some people say that we are in the midst of famines in this country. What's happened to our food is it's become more filling, simply filling, and less nutritious. And then there's been an advent of a host of diseases, including, you know, obesity and gluten intolerance, mm-hmm. that have been connected to the way we are breeding vegetable varieties for shipability, for looks, for disease resistance, and not so much for nutritional content or how they operate within the human body.
Mm-hmm. And one more angle here that I consider positive and inspiring. You have a blurb on your book from Bill McKibben, and he's been a leader of many movements. Last year, the effort to block the construction of the Keystone XL pipeline. He's a brilliant guy, a great writer, and a fun guy to talk to. And one of the cases that he makes is that the way to regain local control and to take on corporate power, and not just in the food supply, is the organic farmers who offer their produce at local farmers' markets.
Right.
And he has a whole case built around the vitality of those markets as a way of avoiding giving your dollars to Safeway or Walmart, who in turn are driving down prices, forcing higher yields and the kind of filler but not nutrition that you referred to a moment ago. Mm-hmm. And so I find McKibben's argument very compelling. And it really has caused me to make regular visits to our local farmers markets here.
I'm so glad you mentioned Bill. He's such an amazing man, and a friend and a hero, a wonderful person. In one of Bill's books, he talks about the happiness quotient, that people are much happier at farmers markets than they are in stores. And it's just the Green Revolution also ushered in this movement from the storied to the acultural. And I think we forget just how, you know, what community-based, story-loving, land-loving people we are. And farmers markets return us to that. Not only farmers markets, Peter, but this entire new food movement that we're all swept up in and a part of is I think it really just returns us back to the fact that we as a species are story-needing, story-loving people. Stories tell us who we are and how to live. About corporations, I always say, and I may have gotten this from Wendell Berry, I'm not sure, but give your money to your friends and not your enemies, which when you put it that way, it makes complete sense that you would try to keep a dollar circulating in your local community for as long as possible. You know, you give it to the farmer at your farmer's market for a dozen eggs, but then that farmer pays another local farmer who's growing a local grain and making it into feed for the chickens, and on and on and on. But yes, Bill has been just a pivotal man, an amazing man, especially in the new climate movement.
Well, he's very smart and strategic as well. I give him credit for that. We're talking with Janice Ray. Her new book is The Seed Underground, A Growing Revolution to Save Food. And we may be joined by an activist from here in California, Pam Larry. She is scheduled to join us for this conversation. And she is a grandmother from Chico, which is in the northeast portion of California. And over the last few years, she's become the mother of an effort to force labeling of genetically modified organisms that are turned into food products. And that is Proposition 37, which is on the November ballot here in California. And we will circle back to that, and hopefully Pam will be able to join us while we're talking with Janice. Now, in your book, you have a very clear and succinct 9-point listing of how the American food system is broken. So let's traipse through these points here, Janice, because I think they're all very important. We've touched on the 94% of varieties that are no longer available. They are potentially extinct. We can't be sure of every individual variety. But you also talk about corporate farming. That's your second point. And agribusiness really has become a bane on our existence. And while, you know, we look at the productivity and we pat ourselves on the back that, you know, that there are fewer Americans who go hungry every day, we have more problems with distribution, I think, than production in terms of feeding all of our citizens and perhaps people in other countries. But the creeping control of corporations here in California is reflected by the muscular way they grab our water supplies. And they get subsidized water from federal projects. They grab it from the Sacramento River Delta. And Governor Brown is at it again. He's proposing a new peripheral canal system to divert Delta water into the Central Valley, and so they can wash cars and water lawns in Los Angeles. You can tell I'm a big fan of this. But the expansion of corporate power in factory farming, in almost every case, goes too far and leads to, in the case of pig farming, massive pollution. And in the case of crops, plants, and those for consumable products, we have seen the development of these GMOs. So take a moment to talk about the difference between hybrid seeds and GMO seeds, if you would, Janice.
Peter, I want to mention a quote first by Wendell Berry that I see here. It says, "The people will eat what the corporations decide for them to eat." Hybrid seeds are offsprings of genetic crosses of parents of with unlike characteristics. So let's say that we wanted to develop a tomato that tasted like tasted like an heirloom, like it tasted like a Brandywine, but we wanted to have a wilt resistance to a fusarium wilt, say. Mm-hmm. So we would, you know, over time in laboratories, the plant breeders will cross a fusarium resistant variety with an heirloom, working toward an heirloom, a tomato with flavonoids, but yet has this disease resistance. Now, what happens is that they usually produce what's called an F1, which is first filial cross. Then when they sell those seeds are reproduced, and the recipe for them is patented. They're sold to us. Now, I grow this new tomato, mm-hmm. and I eat the tomato, but before I eat it, I squeeze out the seeds and dry them and save them for next year. Mm-hmm. Next year, when I plant those hybrids, I'm not going to get the same plant that I planted. I will get any of the ancestral strains used in the breeding lines. Genetic modification is different in that it is the artificial insertion through DNA of characteristics from any kingdom of life. So animal DNA, virus, bacteria can be inserted into the DNA of plants. GM seeds were first introduced in 1996. So there are many problems, and I'm hoping Pam gets on because she'll be able to speak so much more brilliantly about this than I. I wanted to jump back into the caller from Vermont, and she said something so beautiful. And she said the system is so broken, not only broken but destructive and self-destructive. And now at this point, I didn't know what system she was talking about. Did she mean the agriculture, food system, political system? But I stayed quiet and I kept listening to her. And she said, "I see in activism a kind of futility. The real power is in doing, in making the current systems irrelevant. That means non-participation in the existing broken systems. It's easy to look around and see where the systems are broken, that you have a company like Monsanto that started out as a chemical company developing this seed called Roundup Ready soybeans, for example, which meant a farmer could spray the field with chemicals, with Roundup, an herbicide, then plant this certain seed from Monsanto and come back and now no longer have to use hand weeding or mechanical harrowing to weed the field, could just keep spraying the field with chemicals. GM crops have led to an increase of 383 million pounds of herbicide in the first 13 years of their use. Because that Roundup Ready soybean is essentially wearing a raincoat that protects it from the herbicide.
Mm-hmm.
Their seed companies are expanding laterally through the seed market, buying up these small regional family-owned seed companies, and they're also expanding horizontally from chemicals into other. Other things. That's what capitalism does. That is the old model of progress.
And let me quote from your book here briefly, Janice. In November 2004, Monsanto acquired three Iowa seed companies, Crows, Wilson, and Midwest. In 2005, Monsanto announced it intended to expand and spent $1 billion for Seminus, the world's largest producer of fruit and vegetable seed. In one fell swoop, Monsanto was the largest seed and biotech company in the world. It surpassed DuPont. On the heels of this purchase, Monsanto bought NC Plus Hybrids, the supplier of corn and soybean seed from Lincoln, Nebraska, and Emergent Genetics, a cottonseed company. $52 million later, in the fall of 2005, Monsanto owned Fontenelle Hybrids in Nebraska, Stewart Seeds, Indiana, Trelay Seeds, Wisconsin, Stone Seeds, Pleasant Plains, Illinois, and Specialty Hybrids. By 2006, 10 companies controlled half the globe's commercial seed sales. Monsanto led the vanguard, and its market share for seed corn was 36%.
Mm-hmm.
And I share your concern here, and I wonder, whatever happened to antitrust action at the good old Justice Department, but the vertical integration of a monopoly on certain seeds, or at least certain crop seed lines, with the pesticides that are recommended or actually end up being required to effectively grow and develop good yields from these seeds, then you are locked in for both seed and pesticides to a single company. And as we'll discuss in a moment in the case of Percy Schmeiser, you know, they are very aggressive in the way they do this. If it were a benign kind of aggregation in order to protect the seed supply or to, you know, reduce hunger in the world, which is one of the phony arguments they advance for GMOs, you know, I might sit still for it. But what we're seeing is just this bare-knuckled, profit-taking approach to a very aggressive domination of both of these industries.
You know, Peter, I didn't mention a minute ago when I was explaining the difference between hybrid and GM is that in both cases, the farmer or the grower is required to go back to the seed company. So my grandfather was a small, diversified farmer who would, you know, grow fields of sprawling watermelon vines, and he would just save a few of his best watermelons, collect the seeds out of them, dry them, and replant those the following year. So in this process, he was creating these locally adapted place-based seeds. As hybrid seeds became more popular, and now GM seeds, sort of, I don't know if they become popular or they're forced upon us, then less and less of our farmers are growing their own seeds and more just having to, you know, truck down to the local hardware to replenish. Right now, currently commercialized GM crops are five main ones: soy, cotton, canola, sugar beets, and corn. 88% of all corn grown is GM corn, and the figures are about the same for the other five. Now, an aside is there less than 50% of Hawaiian papayas are GM, and we also have now a small amount of zucchini and yellow squash that are commercially grown, GM yellow squash. But in general, soy, cotton, canola, sugar beets, corn. Well, look at this. Three crops, there are three foods, E.O. Wilson writes about this, that stand between us and starvation. These are his words. And these three crops are wheat, corn, and rice. So if you can control, if you can control the grain market, and if you can divert as much of your grain as possible into ethanol and you know, whatever you can do, high fructose corn syrup, all these other things that our number two corn is being used for, then the biotech companies are hoping that means a greater and greater profit for them. There are other things that I think we should be aware of with genetically modified organisms, and one is a ridiculous lack of testing on the part of the FDA.
Right.
A company has 120 days to, you know, present these cursory assessments of allergenicity and toxicity, and all they have to prove is substantial evidence that the plant that they are introducing is substantially equivalent, to something that's already on the market. There are many scientists across the world who are finding that GM organisms are of great concern on the human bodies, that we should be doing studies involving tissue cultures and multi-generational studies and so forth. So,
well, and there are at least anecdotal reports that, for example, herds of cattle that are fed GMO corn develop much higher rates of diarrhea, stomach and GI distress. And again, at least anecdotally, I've heard these stories that when the feed is switched to non-GMO products, that these conditions clear up almost miraculously.
Also, infertility in pigs, and you're exactly right. That and I think some of it, I will say, Peter, is more than anecdotal, that there are actual studies that show this. But then, you know, allergenicity in humans, allergens in Great Britain increased, oh gosh, I forget the percentage, it's like 50% when GM soy was introduced. So that's one major concern. We have no idea what GM products are doing on our bodies. And, you know, with so many of these products, now, I mean, if, you know, if 88% of the corn is GM and 75% of industrial food in the supermarket contains GM, we are no doubt eating it. There's also, we should also consider what genetic, what GM organisms are doing on to the environment, not just with the increase of herbicide use, but the increase in weed resistance that, you know, mare's tail and now pigweed in my part of the country have become resistant to the Roundup, and so farmers are forced, chemical farmers are forced to use harsher and harsher chemicals. And then there's the problem with, you know, like BT, the BT gene being introduced, Bacillus thuringiensis, which is an insecticide, a natural insecticide, but that gene introduced via the DNA into some of these crops, and that affecting insect populations and pollinator populations. Flowering plants have been on this earth for 100 million years, humans for a couple of hundred thousand years. We have been evolving during our whole prehistory. We've been evolving with flowers, with pollinators, and with the food that those flowers produced. And it's, you know, I'm not opposed to science, but I believe that science should act always in the interest of human civilization and never in the interest of profit-making.
And if Monsanto had our best interests in mind, they would not continually block the labeling of food products to indicate whether or not they contain GMO.
That's my thinking, too.
And this is what, let's take a moment here, because I don't think we're going to get to talk to Pam, and maybe I'll be able to interview her separately and add it to this podcast. But Janice, here in California, she has spearheaded the effort, and they got 1 million signatures to put a very simple ballot measure before the voters this November. And it doesn't ban GMOs or place any other restrictions. It simply requires that all food products that are sold to the public indicate if they contain genetically modified organisms. And this seems like a no-brainer. It's polling at 90%, which is extremely rare. You know, ballot measures sometimes, very popular ones, will show 60% support. But we just saw the tobacco industry come into California, and in 45 days, they spent $50 million on negative TV ads, and they defeated a ballot measure on our June primary that would have added a dollar a pack tax to cigarettes. And that measure was polling with 60% support just a month before the election. And so Monsanto and its allies have declared that this is the highest priority of the food lobby to block the passage of Prop 37 here in California. And there probably will be, we haven't seen Monsanto kick big bucks in yet, but they certainly have them and aren't afraid to use them. And so we can expect a really ugly battle this fall, where the pro-Prop 37 forces will probably have $1 million or two to spend, and Monsanto will drown them with $50 or $60 million. And as I said, if the tobacco industry's model is any example, they may be actually able to prevail on this.
Well, let's hope not. All eyes are on California, and thank you all for everything anybody's done to pass that. Vermont's been working on a similar measure without success, for a decade or so. So I'm rooting for California, honestly. Peter, I love this. I love the widespread resistance to corporate control in order that we retain our rights and retain sovereignty over seeds, which is our food supply. But I also love this. There's so many examples of a grassroots uprising to save seeds and protect genetic resources and the diversity of food itself. There's a seed library in San Francisco where people are able to go into this library, check out a packet of seeds in the spring, grow them out, and return the seeds to the library in the fall. which I just think is just the most marvelous idea.
I'm glad to know about that. It's actually the first I've heard, but there are a lot of good things that go on in San Francisco.
That's
now,
right.
Let's take a minute to share the story for people who haven't heard it before of Percy Schmeiser. I've had the pleasure of talking to Mr. Schmeiser in three or four different interviews, and he's become quite an activist. His farm is in Saskatchewan, and some GMO canola seeds blew onto his property. And Monsanto's detectives, I can't imagine how they track all this stuff down, but they managed to discover one of their plants on his property. And so they sent him a bill for $27,000. And he resisted. He carried his case all the way to the Supreme Court in Canada. And ultimately, I believe his appeal was accepted. And Monsanto did not prevail. But it is quite an example of the aggressive tactics they use. And here's a guy who has never wanted Monsanto products on his property. He didn't seek them. He didn't buy them. They arrived uninvited.
Right.
And somehow he was held liable.
Yes, the victim of what's called genetic drift. And in actuality, he never really ruled he never won in the court system. In 2004, the Supreme Court ruled that Monsanto's patent was valid, but because Schmeiser had not gained financially from these seeds, this genetic material on his land, that he didn't have to pay Monsanto. But the way that he did prevail, Peter, is that he turned around and sent Monsanto a bill for about $700 to clean up some more genetic contamination that had been discovered on his farm. Now, that was in 2005, and in 2008, Monsanto settled out of court and paid Percy Schmeiser for cleaning up his field. Mr. Schmeiser is not the only one. You know, this has happened to other farmers. He just stood up, didn't take the victimization sitting down, and he became very well known for it, and bless him for it. But this, he heard someone say to him, "This is our MO. If we intimidate farmers enough that we will win." And I mean Monsanto.
Well, and it really seems criminal to me that they would use the market power that they've been able to attain because of their cash position and use it so virulently against individual farmers. You point out in the book that more than 90 other farmers have been the recipients of these same kinds of lawsuits from Monsanto.
Yeah, it does. It's very worrisome, but you know, so is Order 81. When we invaded Iraq, we put in place these 100 provisional orders, the provisional authority, when Paul Bremer was in charge. And Order 81 forbade Iraqi farmers to use restricted seed. Now, restricted would be patented seed, and you would think, well, what's the problem there? Well, the problem is, Iraqi farmers had been keeping a lot, but most of them bought their seeds from these small regional seed companies. So the seeds were very place-based. There were over 1,000 varieties of wheat, for example. But the biotech multinationals went in and began to patent up these old seed varieties. So it meant suddenly that a farmer that had been, you know, either growing his own wheat seed or her own wheat seed, or buying them from a little co-op down the street, might not be able to do that. And then at the same time, the Army was carrying out something called Operation Amber Wave, which was giving out free to Iraqi farmers wheat seed and chemical fertilizers. But the wheat seeds were genetically modified. So we get back to this the thing that trapped Percy Schmeiser, which is genetic drift. Once old place vintage place adapted vintage heirloom antique seeds are contaminated, then they're contaminated. That's why there are a couple of things that we can do to avoid GM products in our bodies, and one is to hope for labeling and read the labels and decide not to eat it. The second is to eat organic. Organic, by definition, precludes the use of genetically modified organisms. But there are farmers in this country who question whether we can even be organic. If 88% of the corn being grown is genetically modified corn, and corn pollen travels, you know, a half a mile or whatever it travels, how can my Keener corn in my garden, collected from old Mr. Bill Keener in Raven Gap, Georgia, how can I keep those seed pure?
Mm-hmm. It is a real challenge. And I have in front of me, I just want to breeze through this, a list of the top 10 GMO foods to avoid. Corn, soy, and related to soy, it says about 90% of soy is genetically engineered, Roundup ready, and they sold 2006, they sold almost 100 million pounds of glyphosate. I wanted to say glyphosate.
Peter, glyphosate is the generic name for Roundup.
Okay, glyphosate, thank you.
Yeah.
Number three is sugar, my printer jumped to a page here. Anyway, canola, cotton, dairy, and then the surprises to me were 9 and 10, zucchini and yellow squash, and you had referenced that a little bit earlier. We have factory-farmed zucchini and squash now that are based on GMO?
So this was new to me very recently, and the figures that I got were that about 24,000 acres in America, in the United States currently, are being grown in yellow squash and zucchini. So I love that list because it can just let you know that if you're gonna buy organic, definitely start with these. You know, buy organic corn chips, buy organic zucchini. I will also say that even with organic standards, you cannot ensure that 100% of the product is organic. The standards will give some leeway, 95% maybe.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be a challenge, you know. It's just like being surrounded on all sides by soldiers on horseback. And
Janice, we don't protect anybody here on this program, so I have no preconceived notions of how you'll respond. But tell me how you rate the Obama administration on food issues and in particular GMOs.
That is a great question. And on food issues, I've been really pleased with Mrs. Obama's concern that children especially be healthy and the planting of an organic garden. And just to me, it just seems like they are part and parcel of the food movement and are they're part of the vanguard in leading us toward more healthy diets and more organic diets. Having said that, in general, it's almost, Peter, once we see a problem in front of us and we see the solution, like with climate change, we know we need to reduce fossil fuels. I don't see why anything gets in the way. You know, I want the movement to be decisive and quick. When Mr. Obama put Tom Vilsack in charge of Department of Ag, that was worrisome to me because
he is, by the way, the ethanol-fueled former governor of Iowa.
That's right. He has distinct and direct ties to Monsanto. Mm-hmm. You know, being seen flown around in a Monsanto planes and on and on and on. Tried to pass bills that would directly benefit Monsanto. Stopped bills that would harm Monsanto, like the like there were bills that were trying to limit where GE crops could be planted. So that was worrisome. My personal political views are that I won't, when faced with a challenge, I would like a president who would step up directly, adamantly, and meet the challenge, whether it be the health of the American, the health of the world's people because of GM products, or the state of our climate because of the climate crisis.
Mm-hmm. Well, and he, when he campaigned in 2008, Obama said that the climate crisis would be a signature of his administration. And a few months in, he stopped talking about it and hasn't raised the issue since, even with the astounding change by Professor Mueller from UC Berkeley that has been revealed in the last few days. Here's a guy who got a huge grant, including some from the Koch brothers. He entered the fray as a climate science skeptic, and he came out saying not only is it true that the Earth is warming, but that human behavior is the primary driver.
Mm-hmm.
And even, you know, that's a lot of important cover, political cover, in a campaign season like this for Obama. But I predict that he will probably remain silent at least until November. And we'll see if a second term might change his willingness to fight on these issues. Janice, I have one final question, and I was going to ask Pam because she might actually have seen some polling on this. But maybe you have a thought. I don't see the term Frankenfood used very much anymore. It seemed to have surfaced a few years ago and fallen out of favor. And while it may offend some people, I think it's a pretty effective way of describing GMOs and GE foods. What are your thoughts about that word? I don't think I saw it used in the book.
You know, I never even thought about it. I know the word. I see it everywhere. I realize as a writer, I have to challenge myself where I use the same verbiage over and over. So I, for example, rarely use transgenic. I'll use GM or GE.
Mm-hmm.
But you have that's a great food, a great point. I love the word Frankenfood, and I think it does portray the reality.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, listen, it's a real pleasure talking with you. It's as much fun as reading your book. And I want to recommend it both as a cautionary message about the advance of corporate control of our food supply, and in particular GMOs. But it's also a book that is very romantic about gardening and growing your own food, and your love of seeds is something that comes through on just about every page, Janice.
Thank you so much, Peter. And thank you so much for having me today. It's been a real pleasure.
As I mentioned before we started recording, I just wish you were close enough that I could invite myself over for lunch. And joining us now is Pam Larry. As we mentioned in our conversation with Janice Ray, she is the real driver of Proposition 37 here in California. It's on the November ballot. It's a simple statement that requires disclosure of GMOs in foods that we buy. Pam Larry, welcome to the Peter B. Collins Show.
Well, thank you for having me on, Peter.
Now, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got involved in this effort to force disclosure of genetically modified organisms.
Sure. So I am a grandmother from Chico, a little bit north of Sacramento, and I had been studying about this stuff for quite a while and was really pretty upset and disturbed that, you know, people weren't given the right to know what was in their food. It bothered me so much that I literally woke up one morning, January 20th of 2011, actually, and decided that it was my job to do everything I possibly could to get this on the ballot, then won in November of 2012. So since that time, I've basically been on the road in my old Toyota Camry, running around the state. I call her Sally, my trusty steed, and she's got about 305,000 miles on her now. Right now, today, I'm in Modesto, and I'm on my way to Monterey. And I just run around and talk to people and encourage them to get out there on the road with us. So that's how it happens. Literally, that's just that simple.
Was there an article, an event, some GMO corn that got stuck in your teeth? what was the moment on that day 6 or 7 years ago that made you decide that you're going to become the activist that you are today?
Well, actually, it wasn't 6 or 7 years ago. It was January 20th of 2011, so just last year.
Okay.
It was, and that's when I started, basically. Before that, I'd been studying it for quite a while and what I call whining about it, you know, can't believe they blah, 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 you know, on Facebook and stuff like that. And it was actually, I was in a hover state between being awake and asleep. And I've often thought that if I had actually thought this through, it probably wouldn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
But it was kind of one of those intuitive moments that just kind of hit you.
Well, and if you'd talk to anybody who's done a ballot measure before, they'd say, well, you need about $3 million to gather signatures, and then you'll need between $10 and $20 million to take on the corporate giants who will spend three times that amount to try to clobber this.
Yeah, and, you know, it's true. The initiative process has gotten a little strange, you know. One person that does them quite often calls them the initiative industrial complex.
Yeah.
So this is a little bit different. We've kind of thrown everybody for a loop here. We've kind of done it backwards, where we started it out like it actually was this a process was intended for, which is on the ground and in the streets. You know, and it remained that way for quite a while before any kind of professionals or any kind of folks came along to help us with money, because of course we're going to need money to run this no matter how it started.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've had great, like Mercola and Nature's Path and Dr. Bronner's and some other greats and some wonderful organizations that have now joined us. As I have often said, it takes a universal village, not just a village, to raise this puppy. So, and we're doing really well. It's really very exciting.
Yesterday, the Huffington Post ran a story quoting the food lobby, nobody in particular, is saying that defeating Prop 37 is their highest priority.
Yes, I've read that, yes.
And so I'm sure that just makes you more determined. But I also see on the web that you basically have challenged Monsanto to endorse Prop 37.
Well, I didn't do that. I don't know who did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've got quite a few very passionate people out there. Heck, you know, I mean, at one point, I don't know who it was, but someone in Monsanto said, of course, these things should be labeled, you know, because people should have a right to know what they're eating. You know, I mean, there's all sorts of stuff out there. And I encourage, this isn't a campaign about the goodness and the badness of genetically engineered stuff. This is a campaign about disclosure and knowledge. And one would think that with, you know, ethical business practices, that one would be willing to tell the truth about one's product. And I don't know necessarily that it's Monsanto per se, but, you know, the manufacturers out there who have made it their priority to ensure that this doesn't pass, one would think that they would want to have ethical business practices too. Now, that wouldn't necessarily be the campaign talking points. That would be mine.
Okay, I understand. And when you look at this, it's hard to imagine what arguments that they can marshal beyond their own self-interest that keeping people in the dark about what the contents of the food they eat are comprised of is somehow a good thing.
Right. It's pretty shocking, really. I mean, I don't get it. I mean, we label water, we label vitamins, we label protein, we label all sorts of stuff. And, you know, I don't know what they have to hide. I mean, heck, if they're great, wonderful things, then why not advertise where they are so people can buy more of them, you know?
Right.
And in the meantime, those of us who want to know and for our own reasons, whatever they might be, want to avoid them, we have a right to know where they are. I mean, I think it's important to be able to track health issues, you know, which you can't do if you don't have labels. It's important to do all sorts of stuff. You know, there have been no long-term human studies done on these things, not one. The FDA says it relies on producers to determine safety, and producers say it's the FDA's job to determine safety and their job to make money. So I just want to know where that leaves us, you know. I would think that if, you know, people are confused, they would, you know, just want that option. You
mm-hmm.
know, it could be people don't care. We don't know, you know. So anyway.
Now, Pam, as of today here, the last day of July, what do the polls show in terms of California voters' attitudes toward Prop 37?
Well, every poll I ever hear about always says that that labeling has the vast majority, like 90%, of folks want labeling.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're pretty positive, and we're pretty confident that the people will not listen to all of the misperceptions being put out there by the industries that are afraid. They think they might have, you know, some kind of a fiscal impact, but we don't even really know that, you know. We're just asking for a label.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't know how the market will change or won't change. I mean, why would they be affected? You know, people change their labels all the time.
Yeah.
But, yeah, but anyway.
Is that a Monsanto truck bearing down on you in reverse?
It is.
Yeah. I can tell that sound even from here.
How did you know? Yeah, how did you know?
Now, Pam, we saw a remarkable turn of events this spring with the ballot measure. There were only two, and one of them was to put another dollar a pack tax on cigarettes.
Uh-huh.
And that ballot measure was polling to pass,
uh-huh.
not 90%, but it at one point was in the 60% zone. And uh-huh. Big Tobacco came in 45 days dropped $50 million in negative uh-huh. television ads. And they defeated it by, what, only 24,000 votes out of millions cast. So it was extremely close, but Monsanto now has a model that if they're willing to spend $50 million, they might be able to confuse enough California voters to cause Prop 37 to fail. How will you respond to the presumed attacks that will come from the people who don't want us to know which of our foods contain GMOs?
Well, obviously, you know, the campaign professionals have been, and I have been thinking about this for a long time. It was very clear with Prop 29. I would listen to the ads that they had, and I would think, oh, those sound just like what they're going to say about us. They're using already. There have been a couple ads in Humboldt County. You know, they have a website. It's not like they haven't started yet. And we are getting, you know, word that they're actually going to spend more than Prop 29, much more.
Really?
Yep. But, you know, that remains to be seen. You know, my question remains, again, why are they spending so much money on this? You know, but so we have grassroots, we have commercials, you know, radio and TV that are coming, you know, just all sorts of stuff. So we're prepared.
Mm-hmm.
We have a great team out there, you know, who have done this before. We have a wonderful media team that's come on board. We have a amount of social media stuff going on. It's pretty exciting all over the place. Bloggers. I mean, the thing is, everybody's passionate about this, that people are just coming out of the woodwork, you know, to participate and help. You know, we've got concerts going on. We've got, you know, all sorts of stuff.
What is the campaign website for people who would like to get more information?
It's California Right to Know. That's carightsknow.org. And there's all sorts of fun stuff going on there. The website just went live last week. We had a different website, but this one's our new and updated and sticky one. Still making changes, still growing, still having a good time. So, yeah, we're excited.
All right. Well, Pam, thank you for leading this charge. I think you offer an example to many people who care about things and don't know quite how to become an activist. And
yeah.
I really applaud you for being the mother of this particular battle, and I certainly hope you prevail.
Yeah, thank you. We will. And we will when people join us. So we've got thousands of volunteers. We need tens of thousands. Please come and volunteer on the website, endorse the proposition on the website, and get your businesses to endorse and support us. Thank you so much.
All right. Pam Larry, thanks for joining us here on the Peter B. Collins Show. Janice Ray, the book The Seed Underground, A Growing Revolution to Save Food.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.